I'm Christopher Lydon, heading into Harold Bloom's class at Yale on the American masterpiece, Moby Dick. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Harold, it's amazing to me we've never talked about the great Melville or the great Moby Dick. On the way to class, set it in your Bloomian framework.
Well, there won't be time to talk to the children about this today because I want them to read out loud from Moby Dick. They have read the first third of it for today. And I've learned in my old age to keep as quiet as possible in the class. So as we did with Walt, so it will be with Herman. I go around the room. I don't let them volunteer. I volunteer for them. And I get them to read out passages, and then I want them to talk to one another about it. But if I had time, and I don't want to use the time for it today, but we're doing it now anyway, here are the two, I'm convinced, to this moment, greatest figures in the entire history of our national literature, Walt Whitman and Herman Melville. The other possible candidates, including the other three people in this discussion group, Emily Dickinson, Wallace Stevens, Hart Crane, or Robert Frost, to mention somebody else of that stature, or the greatest of our novelists, because Moby Dick is not a novel, it's a prose epic. Mm-hmm. It's a giant prose poem, Shakespearean prose poem, in fact, quite deliberately. Hawthorne, Henry James, to mention only the greatest. Overwhelmingly, of course, Faulkner, particularly. I think the best work by any 20th century American, short of particular poems by Stevens and Hart Crane, As I Lay Dying. An amazing shot out of hell, fully the equal of something like Macbeth. Amazing thing. Faulkner transcends himself there. But if there were time, what I would say to them is, here we are, these are the two great American books, Leaves of Grass in its various editions, but particularly the 1855 first edition, the one hailed by Ralph Waldo Emerson. But side by side with that would be the very best of Melville, the amazing, the miracle of a book, Moby Dick, almost flawless, I think. But here are these two great figures then. They're born within a few months of one another, 1819, I think. They die very close on each other, 1892 or so. They spend their lives in much the same ambience, fundamentally New York City. Moby Dick is published in 1851, the great first edition of Leaves of Grass in 1855. They must have passed each other on the sidewalks of Manhattan hundreds of times. Mm. But neither of them ever acknowledges having run into the other. So here are, these two greats. I don't know what to call them. They're not ships, whales, leviathans, passing in the night and never taking note of the other. And yet I can no longer read one without reading the other, which is why I decided to put Moby Dick into this discussion group. As I say, the first meeting of it will be today. So let us start with Loomings, the first paragraph, beginning with the extremely famous Call Me Ishmael.
It's in that opening chapter, Loomings, that Melville's narrator gives himself a biblical name out of Genesis, the name of the patriarch Abraham's disinherited son. Call me Ishmael, he begins, setting off to recover his sanity on the crew of a whaling ship. Some years ago, he says, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It is a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, and especially whenever my hypos get such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can.
Let's talk about Ishmael. He's, of course, given the name of the cast-out brother by the Egyptian Hagar of Isaac. Therefore, traditionally, the ancestor of the Arabs, the Bedouin, and so forth. Why do you think Melville chooses the name for his? I won't say narrator because something very odd happens, as you've seen already, with Ishmael's function as narrator. At times, he is telling us things that he couldn't possibly have seen or observed where he simply was not present. At other times, he just vanishes inexplicably, and a different narrative voice takes over. He always returns, or almost always returns, and of course at the very end of the ship, at the very end of the book, he is the one survivor in the accents of Job, and I am escaped alone to tell you that brilliant conceit or metaphor, more profound than any metaphor really, of his being rescued by Queequeg's coffin, which he holds on to and is able to survive until the devious cruising Rachel, searching for her lost orphans, her lost children, only found another orphan. What kind of a figure is he in this book? Is he or is he not a surrogate for Melville? Clearly the answer has to be yes and no, no and yes. Why? I think the very choice of Ishmael has a kind of humorous bitterness on Melville's part. He came, of course, from a very august patrician family, going back to revolutionary days and before, very down on its economic status, very down on its fortune in every sense of fortune. And Ishmael, of course, comes indeed from the highest house, as it were, to be, as it were, however, the dark son rather than the light son, not the son who gets the blessing, but the son who is cast out with his mother into the desert. I mean, it's endless to talk about him, and we have to go on. Look at Elijah the prophet, the chapter. What chapter is that, dear? Chapter 19.
Elijah, in Moby Dick, is the ragged, pockmarked old sailor at the dock in Nantucket who warns Ishmael and his friend Queequeg that their one-legged captain Ahab was maimed and cursed by a whale. What? The captain of our ship, the Pequod? Aye, among some of us old sailor chaps, he goes by that name. You haven't seen him yet, have you? No, we haven't. He's sick, they say, but is getting better and will be all right again before long. All right again before long, laughed the stranger, with a solemnly derisive sort of laugh. Look ye, when Captain Ahab is all right, then this left arm of mine will be all right. Not before.
Marvelous writer of dialogue, Melville. Not after this. Well, perhaps in Bartleby the Scrivener and in Benito Cereno, but not even in Billy Budd, and certainly not in Pierre and all those other, or the much overpraised these days, The Confidence Man, which I find barely readable. What's the point of the dialogue? First of all, Elijah, having just published a book on the King James Bible, he's much in my head. I still remember as a little boy sleepily watching in fascination at the Passover feast, at the glass of wine always set aside for Eliyahu Hanavi, that is to say, the Navi or Nabi, the prophet Eliyahu, Elijah. And I always had the sleepy fantasy that he had shown up, and I thought I could see that, you know, the glass was slowly being diminished. But of course it wasn't. But go on, dear.
Ahab, like Elijah, is a biblical name of a lesser Hebrew king. But Professor Bloom reads greatness in Ahab on the Greek scale. He's making him a dark, defiant hero on the scale of Prometheus, who stole the god's fire.
Why Ahab? Why has Melville done this? I mean, after all, the great... I don't like to call him a hero. When I was younger, I was... He's not a hero villain. He's a great Promethean hero, so far as I'm concerned. And I dislike so much of Melville's scholarship, which says we're to regard him as a very wicked fellow. Yes, no doubt, but so what? I mean, he's so sublime, he's so grand that... Yes, he does take everybody down to destruction, but without that destruction, no book. And without the book, where is our literature? You know, so he is a magnificent figure. But why give him the name of the biblical Ahab, who, by the way, is getting a very bad press from the followers of Eliyahu? Impartial historians point out that he's one of the most successful kings of Israel, that he vastly enhances the realm, evidently governs well and so on, but he's fiercely opposed by the prophetic tradition, Elijah, who's quite mad, and his disciple Elisha, who's horrible as far as I'm concerned. But then, you know, I'm not, except for Amos, except for Amos, I'm not much moved by the prophets. I wouldn't want to have dinner with any of them, nor would you. Especially that madman Jeremiah, or the utter raving maniac, the maniac of genius Ezekiel. Very bad lot. So, you know, Ahab gets a very bad press, permanent. But how does he end? Nobody names their daughter Jezebel, but historically she seems to be quite a good thing also. Probably of the family, you know, of Dido. What happens to the two of them in the biblical text? Perfectly ghastly, too. She is defenestrated, of course, in a rather ghastly scene. As for Ahab, he is struck down by the horrible, bloody-minded king, taking his place, Jehoshaphat, highly orthodox indeed, monster. And the dogs lick their blood, as Elijah prophesied. Why name him Ahab, since it's at such variance with the great, all right, you don't want to call him a hero, the great protagonist of Moby Dick. Certainly, you know, one of the four or five great fictive figures in the history of the country. I can think of only a few rivals. One would certainly be, quote, Walt Whitman, close quote, who, after all, is a fiction, a great fiction. Why do you think Melville risks it? Which is, I suppose, what this wonderful dialogue is really about. It's a large question, but I think we should talk about it now before we press on. So, turn to page 140 in chapter 36. So, top of page 140 in this edition, starting with, hark ye yet again. Take an immensely deep breath.
It's on the quarterdeck in that chapter 36 that First Mate Starbuck tells Ahab it's madness and blasphemy to be obsessed with vengeance on a dumb brute. Ahab roars back, hark ye yet again. Ahab is going to strike through that whale like a prisoner through a wall. To me, he says, the white whale is that wall, shoved near to me. He tasks me. He heaps me. I see in him outrageous strength with an inscrutable malice sinewing it. That inscrutable thing is chiefly what I hate. I will wreak that hate upon him. Talk not to me of blasphemy, man. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me.
My favorite sentence by him, which I always contrast, I was saying this to these two gentlemen to my right earlier today, the great contrast to the sublime Walt, dazzling and tremendous, how quick the sunrise would kill me if I could not know and always send forth sunrise from myself, to I'd strike the sun if it insulted me.
Ahab knows that his rant has silenced Starbuck, who cannot oppose me now, he says, without rebellion. God keep me, keep us all, murmured Starbuck, lowly.
Let's go back to the deep source of all this, which occasionally it breaks the surface, but Melville makes it implicit throughout and, of course, deeply renewed in the epilogue. I only am escaped alone to tell you, the book of Job. What is the Leviathan in the book of Job?
Beyond.
It's the tyranny of God over nature, and therefore the tyranny of God over you and myself, yes. Men and women and all of us, young and old. And the cruel, taunting questions. You know, Melville learns, as almost everyone has learned in the Anglo-American tradition, the use of the rhetorical question from those tremendous rhetorical questions spoken by the voice of Yahweh out of the storm, the whirlwind. Whirlwind is actually a mistranslation. You know, the great wind of the storm is coming upon one, and the voice of Yahweh is heard unmistakably and threateningly and exultingly rejoicing, being very bitter and cruel in its ironies against not just Job, but all of us alike. Canst thou draw out Leviathan with a hook? To which Ahab's answer is clearly yes in thunder, rather than no in thunder. He intends to do it by identifying the white whale, Moby Dick, with the Leviathan. What is happening in this great book? It's a long, very complex tradition of the Leviathan. In terms of political philosophy, it produces that great and savage work by the great materialist philosopher and indeed imposer of tyranny, Thomas Hobbes, the great and really frightening book called Leviathan, which is in the end a vast insistence on the dominance of the state over all of us. Melville, like Whitman, is fiercely a Democrat with a small d. They happened also to be Democrats with a large d, politically. And one thing that he likes about Ahab, of course, as indeed the whole crew, the harpooners, the mates, everyone, he even invokes the spirit of Andrew Jackson, since he's a Jacksonian Democrat, as indeed Whitman was, saying, you know, they rise from the dust. They are, you know, the common man exalted. So the rebelliousness partly comes out of that democratic root in the double sense, capital D and small d alike. But in the end, the shattering effect is to dispute the fundamental basis of Western monotheism, which is that the tyranny of nature over man is sanctified by God himself in all three of the traditions, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, down to this current day. Something I've always found intolerable, being a sort of natural Jewish Gnostic anyway. I got into quarrels with the rabbis, I remember, at my bar mitzvah at the age of 13, and now a mere, my God, almost 70 years ago, I got into terrible fights with them because I just couldn't stand what was being said. There is a tradition, and Melville knew a great deal of esoteric material. He had read Gnostic and Hermetic scriptures. He writes a rather striking poem called Fragments of Lost Gnostic Poem of the 12th century. There is a tradition, originally, I suppose, Jewish Gnostic. It becomes a great Kabbalistic tradition that eventually what the Zohar calls the companions will, when Yahweh relents and the restoration comes for all of us, that the companions will actually be handed over the Leviathan, will slay it, a great prophecy of Isaiah, in any case. On that day, the Lord with his great and sure and swift sword shall slay Leviathan, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. So the sanctified tyranny, in fact, it's a very strange Kabbalistic tradition, almost grotesque, because the companions, you know, those who have the mystical light, as it were, in this great consummation, actually roast this vast creature and devour it. How well Melville was available, you know, had available to him that rather grotesque tradition, I don't know. But something like this is the deep setting of Ahab's quest and of Ahab's fury. But I'm talking more than I want to talk, and I hate it because I interrupted something that I wanted to hear, and we will get back to it now. If man will strike through the mask, how can the prisoner reach outside except by thrusting through the wall? To me, the white whale is that wall shoved near to me. That means a wall, you know, smack up against you so that, you know, you can't move. Sometimes I think there's naught beyond, absolute nihilism, but 'tis enough. And then, amazing writing, he tasks me, he heaps me. I see in him outrageous strength with an inscrutable malice sinewing it. That inscrutable thing is chiefly what I hate, and Zara emphasized this very well, be the white whale agent or the white whale principal, I will wreak that hate upon him. Talk not to me of blasphemy, man. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. And then going on still further with this mode, how do we feel in relation to Ahab here? It's not just, I think, that we're seduced, but something else. What he's expressing is magnificent outrage, an outrage which even heretical tradition, Gnostic texts and so on, Manichaean texts, never expresses with this terrible pungency.
Melville's famous take on the whiteness of this albino whale was that it was the color, the blankness of pure terror. Whiteness is the intensifying agent in things the most appalling to mankind. And here is the Bloom take on the Melville take.
There's a kind of transcendent trope of whiteness or blankness which haunts all of American literature. From Poe and Hawthorne on through Whitman rather desperately in Crossing Brooklyn Ferry in the passage where he identifies with Edgar in King Lear, the best I had done seemed to me blank and suspicious. The locus classicus of it is Emerson, In Nature, the ruin or blank that we see when we look at nature is in our own eye, meaning, among other things, the white of the eye. The axis of vision is no longer coincident with the axis of things. So we behold everything not as transparent, but as opaque. Now he's following from the high romantic tradition, which goes back to two very different sources, two very different blanks, as it were, or whitenesses. One Shakespearean and the other Miltonic. The Miltonic one, of course, the extraordinary, rather heartbreaking emphasis on self in the invocation to Book 3 of Paradise Lost, which is a lament for Milton's own blindness. And nature to me, an universal blank, that is to say, a source of wisdom, light, absolutely cut away from him, opposed to it. And I came to it just yesterday in this room with a group doing King Lear. Kent, who's just been banished for defending Cordelia by Lear, pleads and says, "Let me stay, Lear, and still remain the true blank of thine eye." That's a very different blank. That's the white at the center of a target. You know, the true direction, as it were, when the arrow is shot properly so that you can continue to rely on me when you can't rely upon anyone else. They're two different traditions, but they mingle in the high romantics, in Shelley's obsession in the great meditation called Mont Blanc, in Wordsworth having crossed the Alps without even realizing it, when he had expected a great peak experience or summit in nature, and it was nothing at all. And he said, terrible blankness comes upon him. In the opening of Coleridge's Dejection Ode, and still I gaze, and with how blank an I-E-Y-E, carried on an American tradition through Melville's The Whiteness of the Whale meditation to reach an amazing climax, as we'll see later this semester, in the auroras of autumn of Wallace Stevens. He's on a beach as autumn sweeps in and the enormous glare of the northern lights of the aurora borealis is over him. And he's affrighted. He has a terrible sense of impotence, both indeed sexual because he's an old man, but also a lack of imaginative potency compared to the tremendous glare of the lights. And he's wandering there on the beach. An extraordinary passage. The man who is walking turns blankly on the sand, with a blankling come right out of that kind of tradition, quite specifically. And of course, the great master, more than any other poet in tradition, and we'll see this with Dickinson, of the intransigent blank is Dickinson herself. From blank to blank, she keeps saying, and endless blanks in her work. What has Melville done with that image as he transmits it to those who come after and picks up on everything that had come before him, including Shakespeare and Milton? The origins actually lie further back than that, but that's good enough for our purposes. What is it that he's done in the Whiteness of the Whale meditation? By the way, who's speaking it? Ostensibly, it is Ishmael, but this can't possibly be Ishmael. No way at all. So it is certainly one of those declarations of Melville himself, but not yet have we solved the incantation of this whiteness and learned why it appeals with such power to the soul. The heartless voids and immensities of the universe when beholding the white depths of the Milky Way. Or is it that, as in essence, whiteness is not so much a color as the visible absence of color, and at the same time the concrete of all colors, kind of white light of trope itself, is what is almost deranging Melville here. It's so fierce a thing. Is it for these reasons that there is such a dumb blankness full of meaning in a wide landscape of snows? Passage prophetic a great deal of Wallace Stevens, again, a colorless all color of atheism from which we shrink. But these great killers, including Starbuck, let alone Ahab, they're Quakers. Why? Why? I guess that's almost the last thing I would want to try to get at today. Not that I understand it, but I just want some surmises. You know, supposedly, even in an originally an unorthodox, heretical Christian tradition like 17th century Quakerism, which fascinatingly enough is, of course, the religion in which Walt Whitman was brought up. Hicksite, Elias Hicks, the great circuit rider, half black, half Native American, 81 years old, my age, and Lear's age at exactly the time that in Specimen Days Walt writes about him. An enormous influence, as we partly saw anyway, on the first 1855 Leaves of Grass. Interestingly enough, the old Whitman in Camden, paralyzed and dying, always keeps with him a portrait of Elias Hicks. Whiteness, even in a heretical, originally heretical, dissident Christian tradition, like the Quakerism of James Naylor and George Fox, the founders in the 17th century, whiteness is considered a benign color or lack of color. As in Hawthorne, though he handles it with tremendous dialectical irony, considered almost to be sanctification. To have these ferocious killers of the natural world, these great hunters of whales, who, after all, in relation to these harpoons, however furious they get, are at a terrible disadvantage, except for this great monolithic, vast Leviathan straight out of Job. It's very unfair. And you can feel at times, submerged in the book, Melville's own horror of what is happening. And of course, we know what the ultimate consequence of this, the decimation now of these great beasts who are, by the way, mammals, warm-blooded, breathing creatures like ourselves, almost destroyed now. I mean, for all our Save the Whales campaign, it's hopeless. The Japanese still go out there in particular and slaughter them against all, you know, UN international agreements and warranties. There has to be, though I don't understand it myself, some peculiar inverse ratio between the trope of whiteness in this book and the horrible paradox that these killers, including the gentle Starbuck, still the best lance out of Nantucket, the bravest man in a boat, and the fearful Ahab, they are Quakers, opposed to war to this day, opposed to conscription. I always remember that President Richard Nixon was a Quaker. Heaven help them all and us. Forget that. I'm not supposed to do that sort of thing. It's just a sign that I'm exhausted at the moment and a bit burned out. But I want to hear a few more things about this. And then, I mean, you've all been a great comfort to me today because, frankly, I came in exhausted and I will depart somewhat exhausted, but cheered up by you and cheered up by Melville, of course. What should we do with the paradox of a hunt in which we cannot possibly be on the side of the human hunters, Quaker or not, and have to be on the side of Moby Dick, even though that goes against the deep biblical symbolism which is involved. And Melville is all too aware of this. So let me just hear a few things about this, and then I will heave my exhausted self out of here. And so I see you next week, dears. I just want to be quiet now and listen. Deep and subtle Melville is throughout this book. To quote Ahab, there's always a little lower layer beneath, which, by the way, is a fascinating variant on Satan and his despair on Mount Nephades at the beginning of Book 4 of Paradise Lost. In every deep, a lower deep opens to which the hell I suffer seems a heaven. But it is a kind of a inversion of that. In any case, thank you very much. I must admit I am an old burned out case. Well, see you soon.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation with Harold Bloom on the Yale campus in New Haven. Thanks to Professor Bloom's students, for tolerating our intrusion. The Portico Quartet was our choice to add a little ocean music to the story. Henry Peck is our associate producer. Listeners, readers, the conversation isn't over till you register your comments, your readings of Moby Dick, on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you all for being part of the conversation.